Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We're going to take a little break from politics and all the stuff that we get weighed down with sometimes and talk a bit about something I think that replenishes those who are involved in it, because it, to me, it's a very spiritual undertaking and a practical undertaking as well. We're talking about the gardens around us, the gardens that we plant, the gardens that we weed, the vegetables we grow, the flowers we grow, the shrubs we grow, the beauty we build around us. And many of us do that. And I kind of, one thing I miss about apartment living is I miss my garden. We have with us in the studio this hour Nancy Taylor Robson, who is writes about gardening for House Beautiful. She's a novelist. Her novel, Course of the Waterman, came out in September. Joining us also by Dr. Joan Maloof, who teaches biology and environmental issues at Salisbury University and is the author of Teaching the Trees. And Larry Close joins us. He's a former law school graduate who is now known around the area as one of our fabulous vegetable gardeners in Mount Washington. He started many community gardens around the city. And folks, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Welcome. Just what I said earlier, it sounds a little hokey, but I said something about the spiritual kind of quality of working in the earth and just growing, even if it's this little tiny plot of land in your row house behind your house or a larger garden that you have. There's just something about putting your hands in the earth and just playing with it and seeing something come out of it. I'd like to see what all three of you think of that. We'll start with Nancy Taylor Robson, go to Joan Maloof, and finish with Larry Close.
When I was in college, I lived in an apartment that had a little balcony, and it was over top of the parking lot. So the only thing you saw was a little strip of grass below, and there was a lot of smoke and stuff. And eventually, I filled up the balcony with this sort of barricade of plants and potted things. And I thought, this is as close as I'm going to get to a garden. But it was what saved me while I was in college in the city.
That sounds nice. A friend of mine, Eric Hallengren, he grows all his peppers and plants on the top of his house in these buckets. That's part of his being a bucket gardener.
I think part of the reason we feel so spiritual when we're working in the garden is it's one of the opportunities we have to be silent. So much of life around us is noisy, but when you're in the garden, you can really take time to appreciate the silence. But in with the silence, the small noises from other animals, like the birds singing or the bees. And also there's that trust part. You know, you can prepare the ground and you can put in the seeds, but then you're trusting that this plant will grow up and become beautiful, and it does. So that feels like a gift, too. That's grace.
Larry?
You know, I really like the part that it's something you do yourself. You don't have to be interdependent on anyone else except whoever is making the rain and putting the insects where they belong. And it's really, even if you have mistakes, you can just rationalize them by saying, I'm going to compost them and it's going to make everything better next time. And the other thing I really like is there have been times in my life when I found it very difficult to be generous because I hadn't generated a lot of income. And everyone loves vegetables, and it gives everyone an opportunity to be generous.
Now, the three of you, are you all flower gardeners or vegetable gardeners? Sometimes there's
both.
A mix and marriage, and sometimes there's very different creatures out there.
I do both. I do
Nancy.
All of them. I put in my vegetable garden, I have bulbs and perennials and vegetables and herbs, and as a result, I have bees and critters and all those other things as well. So it's sort of the old-fashioned French garden in a way. It's everything you want to have right in one place.
And right now, I'm doing a lot of flower gardening. And one of the reasons for that is that I do better with flowers than I do with vegetables. And there's a gentleman down the road from me, Jay Martin, who is just the most marvelous organic vegetable grower that there is. So I let Jay do my vegetables, and I do the flowers. But having said that, I can't resist tucking in, of course, some basil and some tomatoes and other herbs.
You're a vegetable man, Larry Close.
Well, I am a vegetable man. I've been growing in the same spot in Mount Washington for 30 years now, and I teach vegetable gardeners to the master gardeners when in the training course. But I was blessed when I moved to Mount Washington with 150 by 150-foot lot, so we've really gotten into landscaping, and I have a really nice pond, and I don't know. It's water gardening, I guess it's called. And my wife is just excellent at design, and she's very good with that. She starts all her own plants in the house, and the yard is beautiful. We love it.
When you talk about the gardening, I mean, it's often seen as something that is just for the upper class, for people with money, with people with of means. Oh, I'm going gardening. I have my garden in Roland Park. But it really is beyond that. I mean, you've seen that, Larry, the work you've done. I mean, in creating these city gardens.
Community gardens are wonderful places. I mean, they end up being families of people. They get to know each other, and they spend a lot of time together, and they share a lot together. It's important to neighborhoods. There's a garden we built in Reservoir Hill in the inner block lot, and now a year later, lots and lots of the houses on those inner blocks are being fixed up, mainly, I think, because of the spirit of that garden.
It builds community.
Yeah.
That's what it does.
Yeah,
it builds community. Because then you share something that's really worth, you're nurturing things together.
Right.
Yeah.
And all you need is sunshine. Even if you don't have any land,
rain.
You can grow in containers.
Yeah.
So all you need is sunshine. Mm-hmm. The idea, though, of gardening, I mean, it's kind of so universal that people, wherever you travel around the city, you see people trying to grow something somewhere. All the inner city plots you see growing, people's gardens in the county, in the country, people's little suburban lots. And I think there's also a lot of controversy runs around it, too. I mean, people argue about what to do with their gardens. I mean, you'd mentioned the guy down the street from you, Joan, who does organic gardening. But everybody doesn't do organic gardening. And there's this whole battle over what you put in the earth in terms of what comes up, you know? I mean, it's not so easy to grow organically.
Well, it's hard work. I was just this morning, I went out in my nightgown with one of my dogs to walk out back, and for the first hour I was getting, dirt all over me because I was yanking up the bindweed that was busy trying to eat the tomatoes. So, no, it isn't. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of muscle power. And you have to be really careful. You have to do some research, too, to figure out if you want to do the organics. You've got to time things. You have to know what the bug's life is or what the things that's going to attack your plant life is. You have to know more than it takes to walk out with something that's a pesticide and sort of do this clear-cut thing.
Do all of you do that organically?
I grow completely organically now. And when I've done a 180-degree turn. When I first started gardening, and the way I learned was with the chemicals, and that's the advice that I would give people when I worked at the Extension Service my first summer. But as I've learned more and more and learned how we are connected to the soil and the things that we eat, I've realized that I would rather have, the old cliche, the holes in my apples, than to have the chemicals in my body. So I feel very strongly about keeping the earth clean and the water clean and the air clean and all that. Depends on what you put on your gardens.
Well, I am not 100% organic. I hedge my bets. There's no doubt about it. To me, product is really important. The reason I grow vegetables, I'm really a self-sufficiency nut. And the reason I grow vegetables is I want food. I had five children. We were self-sufficient in vegetables all through the 70s and the 80s. I do a lot of canning, a lot of freezing. So, I want to make sure that I have food to eat in the winter. So I love composting. I love the concepts of composting. I like using row covers to protect certain plants that don't need to be pollinated from insects. But when you start getting, we're faced with a lot of harlequin bugs right now that are eating everybody out of
what
house.
What kind of bugs?
Harlequin.
Harlequin bugs.
Yeah, and they're eating everybody out of house and home. And they don't come out a lot in the daytime, and they're hard to find, and they're pesticides that are organic, and they do the trick, and you get some food when you're finished.
Now, what are row covers?
It's a floating row cover. It's like a sheet that's very light, and water will go through it, and so will light. And it's really a great tool to have because if you remember the old Jiffy Pop from popcorn days, you put it over the bed of let's say cabbages, and as they grow, the thing lifts up, and then the cabbage butterflies, the white butterflies,
right,
can't get in it. And then when you're ready to harvest them, you take off the cover, and they're insect free. It's really a great trick in gardening.
They also help too with the temperature. Sometimes they can raise the temperature underneath as much as 7 degrees. And sometimes 7 degrees is the difference between having something survive and die, particularly in the kind of spring we had.
But when we talk about chemicals versus organic, even when it comes to lawns, I mean, just people who want to take care of the lawns and trim their shrubs and not grow a whole lot of other stuff and maybe some flowers, it's really hard to do. I mean, people, that's that whole other world about how you keep a lawn. I mean, I hate lawns. I mean, I remember when I had a house in Windsor Hills, people complain all the time. I just try to figure out what to do with my front lawn where I wouldn't have to mow it. I mean, I just can't stand lawns.
So you planted yours.
I guess you're right. Plant your way out of it. Cover it with corn. Do something.
Right. So much of it is a matter of attitude. You know, I don't, because I don't use any chemicals, I have to put up with what other people call weeds in my lawn. I have dandelions and I have clover, but I just learned to appreciate the biodiversity. And when I see the little honeybees flying from dandelion to dandelion, instead of saying, oh, look at the weeds in my lawn, I think, oh, this is fine. It's just another plant species I have here in addition to the grass. But I don't know if you can teach that attitude change. It might be something that has to come from the inside.
Lauren in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi.
This question is for you.
Okay.
I was hoping that your guests would talk about growing vegetables in pots. Like I've seen in several gardening stores that tomatoes can be grown in pots, and I was thinking for your benefit, maybe some other vegetables could be grown in pots.
What about when you have a porch that doesn't have much sunlight, though?
Then you take it out on the ground floor, and you hope that your neighbors are very cooperative with your little vegetable pot.
That's a great idea. Well, maybe we'll try it. Maybe I'll take it up on the roof of the building. That might work. What about gardening in pots?
You can. There are a number of things you can put in pots. You can do
Nancy Taylor Robson.
Peppers, hot peppers, eggplants, tomatoes of all kinds. I've seen people grow leeks in pots. Actually, if you give everything the amount of room that it wants and whatever nutrients and water and stuff and the sun, you can grow almost anything in that little contained space.
But you need sun.
You need sun.
And you don't want the sun to get too hot on the side of the pot because it actually can burn the roots. So if we have really hot, really sunny days, you want to somehow keep that pot cool, either with enough water in the soil or by putting something around it. And make sure there's drainage holes in the bottom.
And nothing beats 5-gallon buckets for getting in, growing cheaply in pots. And be sure to drill some holes in the bottom because it's got to have drainage in order to grow.
I mean, I do miss the being able to go out at night and pick my tomatoes and cucumbers and corn off the stalk and go in and cook dinner. It's just it's a whole other taste.
Corn pick with one hand and pot with the other.
That's right.
Yeah.
Cliff in Mount Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Cliff.
Hello to your guests, and thanks for having this show. It's a pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Hey, Larry, you're my neighbor.
Hi, Cliff.
How are you?
Good.
I have a question for you, and I figured this is a good time to do it. Hey, I got summer squash and zucchini.
Right.
And I'm getting summer squash, but they get about 2 inches long, and then they just shrivel up and fall off and die. Don't seem to be able to manage that. I don't think it's a male-female issue, only because they are producing fruit, but the fruit are shriveling and dying. And one other thing is my tomato plants, I seem to be getting some kind of a wilt every year. For the last 3 years, I've had trouble with my tomatoes. Help me with that.
You want to kick that off, Larry? And then
yeah, you know, I'm having the same problem with my zucchini. They get mushy at the top after, and they only grow to be about the size of a cigar, and they start getting mushy. I'm not sure. It might be a pollination problem. It's the first time I've ever had it. You know, your tomato plant problem is probably a soil-borne disease. It's probably an early blight. And it's good. One good thing to do is take off all the lower branches of the tomato up to about a foot or two. And that way, when it rains, the soil won't wash up on the leaves and it won't transmit the blight. So give that a try, Cliff.
I sure will.
Okay.
Thank you.
And also, just like the farmers rotate, you'll want to not plant the same vegetables in the same spot every year. So if you're having trouble with your tomatoes in that spot, as Larry said, it's probably something in the soil, so try a new spot or a container next year.
On our way to Russell in Baltimore, our next caller, I want to read an email from Catherine in Baltimore. Then we'll go to Russell, who's on the phone. We found a really hideous bug over the weekend. Left it alone because we didn't know if it was a good bug or a bad bug. Something got it because we saw it dead on the driveway. Question is there somebody we can email the photo my husband took so we know what it is, in case there are more, It was black, and it was a black and gray winged creature about the size of a butterfly, but ugly, with a hideous pincer on its head. Thanks, Kathy in Bel Air.
Well, there is a University of Maryland Extension Service hotline, and I don't know the number offhand. You can call 410-396-1888, which is the number for the Urban Gardening Extension Service. Ask for John and ask him if he can refer you to the person who the Extension Service hotline.
If it's a pincer on its head, yeah, if it depends on which way the pincer goes, like a rhinoceros beetle,
guessing
maybe?
Guessing that it was could be a Dobson fly.
Or a Dobson fly.
Which has a phase, the immature phase is actually a water. It lives in the water for a year or two before the adult hatches out, and they are very unusual looking and large with pincers on
it
the head.
Be that.
So it could be that.
It could be that. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. And Nancy says, I don't know.
I don't know. Some of me good bucks, some of them are bad bucks to have. I just don't know.
Russell in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Russell.
I'm on speakerphone with someone else. Does that work?
For a bit, but it's better if you're on your real phone. It helps us hear you better.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll have to pass the message along then.
Sorry about that.
First question is about hollyhocks.
Uh-huh.
Someone here in the office has hollyhocks that get beautiful blooms, two or three of them come out, and then the rest of the buds just shrivel up and die.
Okay.
Any thoughts on that?
Maybe fungus?
Fungus?
Make sure when you water them, I would say only water in the morning if possible. Sometimes you can't avoid it because we'll have weather with a lot of dew and condensation, and then the fungus could spread. But if you have a choice, if you only water in the morning, that way the buds have a chance to dry off, and then the fungus doesn't spread as easily on a dry plant.
Okay. I guess we could water just the soil.
Yes.
Try to keep it off the leaves.
Yes, absolutely.
And they need lots and lots of sunlight.
Lots and lots of sunlight. Yeah. Great. Okay.
You had two questions, didn't you, Russell?
Yes, I did. The other question was mine. I'm looking for some recommendations for herbs that could be planted now for a fall harvest.
Herbs? Well, I think we had at least all of you do herbs, and I know that, Joan, you said you do them, and Larry, Joan, you want to start? Then we'll go to Larry Close.
I'd say plant anything.
Yeah.
Anything you
can
get in the ground, whether it's an annual or perennial.
Okay.
It's not too late. In fact, if you planted some herbs earlier, they're going to seed by now, so you're going to be just in time to get some nice herbs.
Is there a difference between growing, herbs and other vegetables? I mean, I've never tried to grow herbs. How difficult is it to kind of get an herb garden going?
It's not hard at all. And some of the herbs are annuals, and the annuals are the ones that you'll
As in what?
Basil. Dill,
cilantro.
Mm-hmm. Parsley is a biannual, but you can do sort of this leapfrog thing with it. You can plant it in spring and then plant it again in sort of late summer.
And what was that one?
Parsley.
Parsley, okay.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. But you can put any of the perennial herbs in the ground at any time, too. But they really love being planted in the fall, particularly, because then they really develop a really solid root system.
And those would be like rosemary or thyme or oregano.
Oh, sounds like I've gotten lucky by waiting.
Mm-hmm. And I have one suggestion, which is not going to endear me to a lot of garden centers, but lemon balm. Once you plant lemon balm, you will have lemon balm everywhere and be digging it out and yanking it out. It's got an incredibly thick root. Mm-hmm. It's a mint family, and if you've ever planted mint, you know that mint really spreads through. And so you have to
watch
if you
it.
Really want it. You need to really contain it, and you don't want it to go to seed because it'll send seed out, too.
And you can come to my house and get some if you need some.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I have plenty of that.
Oh, dear.
The wood behind my house is taken over. I really need to do something to get it in check.
It makes wonderful tea. Wonderful tea. Just pour a little boiling water on it.
I'll try that.
Stuff it in
a
chicken, too.
It's funny, somebody mentioned, you mentioned dandelions, and one of the things I noticed in Vietnam was whatever they grow, is they eat the greens of it.
Mm-hmm.
We had every kind of green, pumpkin greens, dandelion greens. Mm. They were just delicious.
Carrots, yeah.
The greens off of most plants. Mm-hmm. You can turn into like collard greens, whatever kind of greens you like. It's just, and I'm a big greens fan, so that was really kind of never tried this. I have to try it here.
Yeah.
Turn your dandelions into a green salad.
Yep.
Then we're going to go to Dave on his cell, but first Kimberly writes in, if you have a balcony, there is no reason not to have a garden. I have peppers, beans, herbs, and an eggplant growing on my balcony. And I've already begun eating tomatoes from my plant, which is full of flowers and has five more tomatoes ready to drop. The only problem is my cat, seems to view the whole thing as a salad bar for him. Better a salad bar than a cat box. So, so take heart, Mark. You too can have a balcony garden. And Dave, on your cell phone, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Listen, I don't want to sound too ignorant about this, but I have a tree in my yard. It's an apple tree. Don't ask me what kind. But they're all small and gnarly, and I know nothing about that. How do I make it produce better apples? Do I need more trees?
Joan, are you the tree woman?
This is one of the cases where it's very difficult to be an organic gardener, because the fruit trees around here, to grow them well without the regular spray program is difficult. And there's all kinds of diseases that... What happened was when they bred the newer fruit trees, they bred them in a lot of cases to not be resistant to the diseases, thinking that people would spray. So if you want beautiful apples, you really need to be on a spray program, unless you are very skilled at using just the right nutrient levels and the organic controls. So maybe Larry could have some more helpful.
Well, I was just going to say that that's a great question for the Extension Service hotline. And I didn't bring the number with me today, but if you call 396-1888 and ask for John, he'll put you in touch with the hotline.
Thank you.
Any thoughts, Nancy?
I was going to say Dorman oil spray. I used to spray all of our apple trees with Dorman oil spray, but the key very much is timing.
We're looking at the world of gardens and our gardens and your gardens this hour. You just heard Nancy Taylor Robson, author of a novel called Course of the Waterman. We're joined by Dr. Joan Maloof, who teaches biology and environmental issues at Salisbury University and wrote the book Teaching the Trees. And Larry Close, one of our most famous community gardeners, is in the studio as well. And Jean in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Jean.
I actually have a question about growing trees in containers. Mm-hmm. I live in a row house, and we have a light well in between our house and our neighbor's house. It's about 10 feet wide, and it faces northeast, so it doesn't really get any sun. And so I was wondering, it seems like the kind of species that you plant is really important, and so I was wondering if you guys had suggestions for trees that would grow, you know, 6 to 8 feet tall, but not get too wide, and would take a northeast exposure.
Let me throw this to Joan and Nancy first, who wants to grab this tree question.
Dogwood is the first thing that came to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because dogwood is usually edge of the forest, dappled shade. And I've got Coosa dogwoods, which are fairly tough. The Florida variety are the beautiful ones that we have all over Maryland and the edges of the woods. And I love those. But the ones that are tougher, actually, and I've got on the north side of our house, are Coosa dogwoods that set those flowers above the leaves.
Mm-hmm. I think the Coosa dogwood is a good choice. But instead of thinking trees, I think you'd be better off thinking shrubs, because most of the shrubs will actually grow to be 8 feet tall, and then you won't have something that'll outgrow its container in 5 or 6 years, and you'll have to do something about it. So something like even a butterfly bush or a cuba or even the old-fashioned forsythias. Wigelia, those are tough shrubs that should do well in containers in that spot.
And in the instant gratification department, we have an email here back from Catherine, who writes in, "You guys are great. Just went online, looked at a picture of a Dobson fly, and ding, dong, ding, we have a winner." And Lewis in Catonsville, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis.
My question is concerning my flower garden. I live in Catonsville, and, on my quarter acre, I have a lot of flower gardens, and my phlox, there's a section of it that every year gets fungus on the lower leaves, and then it kind of spreads. And as soon as I see it, I'll spray it with a fungicide, but then, of course, that kind of leaves a white residue all over the leaves, which isn't very pretty to look at. And also on the phlox, they seem to be doing really great, and then all of a sudden, the very top leaves will kind of wilt and die out. And I'm just not sure what to do about that.
Joan, Nancy?
Well, I'll take the white fuzz. Nancy can take the brown tops. I don't know about the brown tops.
I don't know anything about them. You take the brown tops, too.
But the The white fuzz is a downy mildew, so it's another fungus, and it's very common on the phlox, and I have it on mine at home. And that's another case where you should never spray with water the leaves of the phlox plant, only water from the base. You just water the soil. Now, when we have the humid weather, again, you can't help it. The fungus is going to grow. And I would just not worry about it. It's not going to kill the plant. It may look bad, but as you said, the spray looks bad too. So you just live with it, and hopefully in the fall you get some cooler weather and it straightens out. Now, one thing that you should make sure of, though, at the end of the season, cut off the tops of the phlox plants and compost them or burn them, get rid of them, put them away from the plants for next year, and that way you're taking away some of the inoculant, and hopefully next year's plant will be off to a better start.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. This hour we're talking about the wonderful world of gardening and being in the earth. Community gardens, gardens in your backyard, gardens in the pots on your porch, with our three guests. Nancy Taylor Robson writes about gardening for House Beautiful. She's also a novelist. Her novel, Course of the Waterman, came out in September. Dr. Joan Maloof is with us, who teaches biology and environmental issues at Salisbury University and is the author of the book Teaching the Trees. And Larry Close is with us, one of the community gardening activist in our community, who's upstart garden across Baltimore City. He's a former law school graduate who's known around town as one of the great vegetable growers, and as he said earlier, grew for his own survival in Mount Washington. Nancy, could you tell the story you just told her in the break about when I talk about social issues in gardening, what you just said?
We were talking about, you know, the politics and social issues versus something that seems as soft as gardening, and
right.
Yet I was calling California doing a story, and in the course of the conversation, the person I was talking to said, "Do you realize how important community gardens are?" He said, after the Rodney King riots, the only thing in those neighborhoods that remained untouched were the community gardens that everyone had a vested interest in.
Art, on your cell, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Hi, I really enjoy your show today.
Thank you.
I have a cranberry coolie daylily I ordered from an internet supplier. It's a bare root plant I started in a container last year, and while it thrived, it did not flower. And at the end of the season, I dug it up and planted it in one of my flower beds, and it is now in the midst of flowering beautifully. But it appears to have turned into two plants where it was one. And I know that you're supposed to occasionally dig up and divide daylilies, and I was wondering when should I do that and how do I go about doing it?
Hmm.
Well,
go ahead, Joan.
Daylilies are really tough, and as you see, they spread. So, you know, you're doing something right. Lucky you. You have two plants where you had one. And you can actually just let that go for a while. I would, until you get even more divisions. I might wait another year or two. And then daylilies aren't really picky, so you would want to dig it up to divide it any time that it's not in its active full leaf growth. So you could either wait till this fall after it starts dying down and dig it up and divide it then, or you could get to it very early in the spring when it has its little green shoots just starting to come out. So either one of those would be a fine time to divide.
You can agree.
Oh, yes,
wonderful.
Yes, me too.
I really enjoy it, and I want to keep it healthy and happy and hopefully have even more in the future.
You will.
Thanks, Art, for the call.
Thank you.
Catherine in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Catherine.
I have a flea beetle infestation in the eggplant section of my vegetable garden. And I garden organically, and a company recommended an organic pesticide called, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, pyrethrin or rotenone.
Rotenone.
Yeah. And
pyrethium.
Pyrethium.
And rotenone.
And rotenone.
Two organic pesticides. Excellent ones.
And, well, I sprayed, and it did seem to control at least one generation of the flea beetles, but then all the ladybugs in the garden were killed also.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, they're indiscriminate. All the poisons are indiscriminate. So, if it injures one, a good bug, it injures a bad bug too. So
what can I do about the flea beetles to control or get rid of this colony? They're munching pretty heavily on my eggplants.
Yeah, it looks like gunshots, right? The little holes all in the leaves, so other people know what they look like.
Exactly.
Do you have a suggestion?
No, I just squash things. I tend not to spray anything because I want the whole kit and caboodle in my garden. So I go around and I squash the Japanese beetles and I squash whatever I come across as I'm picking and weeding and all that kind of stuff.
Flea beetles move fast.
and they're teeny weeny too.
And sometimes they're more of a problem in the beginning of the season. So if you can get the plant growing fast enough, sometimes it'll actually kind of outgrow the flea beetles. Do you find that?
Yeah, it just, you know, sometimes there can be some damage and the plant will do fine. And the life cycle of the beetles, you'll outrun the life cycle. Some people put lime powder, you know, dust it with lime. You can try that. I've heard that as a cure.
Will they die over the winter?
Yeah, definitely. You know, they're a warm weather crop, and as soon as it gets cold, the frost will kill them.
So they're not going to winter over, and I'm not going to have flea beetles next year, assuming we get a snowstorm or a good freeze?
That's right.
Okay, great. Mark, I think you should have a gardening show every week.
Well, at least every month. We just were talking about that during the break. Thanks so much.
Thank you very
much.
It
is a lot of fun. I think it's good for us to think about other things sometimes like this. Let me two emails, and go right back to the phones here. Let's see. We have one email here that asks, do your vegetable gardening guests grow for taste or for yield? That is, do they grow heirlooms or dependable commercial varieties that may not taste so good? What varieties do they recommend? You all want to go down the line here and talk about that?
Oh, you're the grower.
I go for yield. For example, I make a lot of tomato juice, tomato paste, canned tomatoes, and I really recommend celebrity tomatoes because they are really disease-resistant. And then other really disease-resistant things are like cucumbers are very difficult to grow because there's a cucumber beetle, which is really insidious. It not only puts holes in your plants, but it gives the plant a disease. And I recommend Marketmore 76, which is really excellent. But friends of mine grow for taste, and sometimes they don't get any product. So it's just up to you.
Nancy and Joan?
I think the key is freshness. It really doesn't matter what variety you grow. If you can eat it as soon as possible after it's picked, and that's one of the best reasons to become a member of one of these community-supported agriculture gardens or to support your local farmers and produce stands, because the average food item has to travel 1,200 miles before it reaches your table.
Right.
And it's not going to be fresh and it's not going to be as good.
It's
so
such a different taste.
If you can get it fresh, doesn't matter what variety it is.
I grow a lot of heirlooms and things because I like to have things that I couldn't buy at the grocery store. And I grow rainbow tomatoes that are absolutely gorgeous. I had 2-pound tomatoes last year that you can slice, and they're like this beautiful sunset on them, you know. And I just like all the different colors and varieties. But I can about 50 quarts of tomato spaghetti sauce a year. So we get yield.
Let me go back to the phones here. And a quick thought, then we'll go to our next callers. We'll try to get them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in a row here, if we can. Ben calling in for Gene in Hamilton wants to know, in the small garden in front of my girlfriend's house, that must be Jeannie, a very large green plant, almost 6 feet tall with very big leaves and 3-inch thick stalk, spontaneously blossomed overnight. Literally. I think it looks pretty cool. Is it a weed? Is it a threat? Should we care? Where do the things come from?
Sounds to me like it's pokeweed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, which is a weed.
And it will take over.
It will take over, and it the berries are poisonous, but it still can be beautiful. It's a plant. It's green, so it's one of those.
Is that the same thing as poke greens?
Yeah, when the plant first comes up, the greens are supposed to be edible, but when the plant gets older, it's poisonous, so I myself have never risked eating the poke shoots.
Pokes.
So
it's
just, and you can use the berries for dye.
Right.
Or throw them at your younger siblings.
Let's go back to the phones. And I want to have Jay in Towson. You're on the air.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a one-acre property in Green Spring Valley, and I garden it completely organically, and I inherited this thing that they call bishop's weed. And every year it's got these long tendrils underground, and it drops these nodes, and it completely strangles out my plants. And I have tried everything to eradicate it, and I'm really adverse to using any pesticides or whatnot, and I'm wondering if you can, if you've encountered this what I call an incredibly invasive weed, and any strategies for trying to get rid of it.
You know what,
Nancy Taylor Robson.
I have gardened organically most of the time I've gardened, but I finally gave up when I ran up against Canada thistles that I could not dig fast enough, and wiregrass, which is similar to what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And I finally just gave up and used Roundup on it because in 3 days, Roundup turns into sugar and water.
Really?
That's what I've been told.
In 3 days?
In 3 days, Roundup turns into sugar and water.
That's interesting.
Well, it's in a garden. It's in a. I've contained it finally in a large garden in the center of my yard, which has a lot of really mature perennials. And so, how do you apply Roundup without killing your perennials?
I have, in fact, sort of taken pieces of board and stuff to blockade them off when I want to get very specific about what I want to get hold of.
Uh-huh. Okay, and that worked for you. It killed it.
It did.
Yeah. And it didn't kill your perennials.
Not when I made sure I didn't get any on the perennials.
Right. That's the part that scares me, you know, with the spray, if I'm able to actually get it onto without spreading it onto my perennials. But you were successful. A big board. Just place it around the perennials at the base of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great.
Joan,
okay.
did you look how you wanted to add something? Or
well, I was just going to say about the, the invasive plants can be such a problem. And that's something that all the listeners should keep in mind when you see a plant starting to get out of control. Do the future property owners and your neighbors a favor and try to control them. And to do it without spray, you just have to attack it from a lot of different directions, keeping in mind that what fuels these plants is sunlight. So if you try to keep the leaf area as small as possible, just try to keep cut them back, then you're going to eventually weaken the roots, and those plants won't be able to spread as quickly. And you can also use things like Nancy was talking about to shade. Like if you have an area where you just want to get rid of all plants there because there's a lot of these invasive plants, you can take an old carpet or a black piece of plastic or a board or something, and if you leave it in place for a year, those plants won't get any sunlight and they'll die. So,
Great ideas.
Thanks so much
for
the call.
Thank you.
Take care. And Wendy in Lutherville, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to let you know that I've been gardening for about 7 or 8 years, and I do a lot of container gardening. I have two-foot by 2.5 foot by 6 foot horse watering troughs that are galvanized aluminum, and I've grown zucchini in them, and right now one of them has three different kinds of peppers, and the other one has string beans, but I grow that and tomatoes and peas. And I make my own homemade tomato sauce, which I just actually made a batch last Friday from the tomatoes and the peppers and the herbs all came from my garden. So it was only the wine and the garlic and the onion that came from somewhere else. And that was kind of nice.
But you could grow those too if you wanted to, I guess the garlic and the onion.
Yes, I could. I could. I have pretty clay-like soil, so I try and go with the things that are a little bit easier.
Do you want to keep this as a tightly held family secret, or do you want to share with us how you make your tomato sauce?
Actually, It's not a tightly held family secret. I had to go out onto the Ohio State University Home Extension website to find out how to make tomato sauce from raw tomatoes, because most of the recipes called for canned tomatoes.
Sure.
So they actually had a recipe. It was about 4 pages that I downloaded that told me how to cut and blanch the tomatoes, peel them, seed them, and, you know, chop them up, and then what kind of things are good to add and when to add them. So it didn't really give you a recipe as much as a set of guidelines. It was wonderful.
Uh-huh. Larry's nodding his head. Yes, yeah, Larry, close here.
I have a secret weapon. I also make a lot of tomato sauce. I have a secret weapon called a squeezo. It looks like an old-fashioned metal meat grinder.
Yeah.
And what it does is you have to heat up the tomatoes first to loosen them, but you don't have to skin them or anything. You put them in the squeezo, and out one end comes the skin and the seeds, and on the other end comes the juice. Now, the thing is, it's cranked. Originally, this was a crank machine, and I figured out if you put a half-inch drill where the crank, a half-inch drill bit onto it, where the crank used to be, that sucker really runs. And I mean, I could go through 8 quarts of tomatoes in about like 5 minutes, and then they're ready to be cooked down to make sauce.
So you jerry-rigged the squeezo.
Yeah, it really runs. But I make a tomato juice. I think it's called Aunt Nellie's. It's got a million and one ingredients in it, and it's just great with Bloody Mary. It's a Bloody Mary mix. But the problem with tomato sauce, though, it's about 5-6 hours of cooking to get it down to a nice consistency that you'd want to be able to use in a tomato, in a pasta. So that takes time.
So it takes a lot of work. You got to love what you're doing, and...
Oh, it's great.
Let's go to Mark in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you guys could describe the procedure for collecting seeds from, let's say, you get your favorite tomato. I saw it briefly in a laundromat. I was watching Martha Stewart like a year ago, but I missed, you know, I don't remember exactly the procedure. Said something about the seeds have a little gel sack around them, and you have to let them mold in order to reuse the seeds.
We have a quizzical look from Larry Close. Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I've read how to do it, and I'm sure if you go online, you're going to find out. It is something about letting them sit for a while, and you don't want to do hybrid tomatoes when you do it, because then it isn't, the seeds aren't true to the hybrid plant, so you never know what you're going to get. You might get some monster tomato that'll take over your whole yard or something.
And Dale in Greenmount West, you're on the air.
I've got a recipe. It's real simple, and I know it's for a vegetable that a lot of people may or may not like, which is squash.
I love squash.
And you do it with potatoes. You can use the skins on the potatoes, too. And you just cut your potatoes up like you're making home fries, and you put them in a pan with a little oil or butter, and you know, let the potatoes cook and caramelize a little bit. And then you put the squash in there. You can cut it up any kind of way you want. And you kind of saute it, and it doesn't become mushy like squash becomes when you kind of boil it or try to steam it. And then you can put onions, and if you're really adventurous, you can put some garlic in it. But it's great, and it's really happy for me. And I did want to ask you just one question, though.
Sure.
For the horticulturist, what can you do to prepare your soil for next year? I had a bad problem with it. It was a vacant lot that I converted this year to a garden, hadn't been using a long time. And I had a problem with wilt this year. And what could I do next year to make that less of a problem, especially with my tomato plants and the squash-type plants?
Yeah, wilt. Well, the rule of thumb is don't plant in the same place for more than 1 year. So you should rotate that crop, those tomatoes, somewhere else and plant something that isn't susceptible to wilts, like beans or peppers into that area.
Into the place where you had the tomatoes that one
where
year
you had the tomatoes.
Right.
So rotate your crop out of that place. And it probably wouldn't hurt to have plant a cover crop this winter, something like a winter rye that'll enrich the soil and maybe get rid of some of the wilt that you have there.
Let's go to some recipes here for a minute. We have one email here from Ruth, who has a really interesting recipe here. All right, let's see. Ruth writes in, I've been going to the Saturday Waverly's Farmers Market for 20 years. Sometimes I find I have to go to the market on the JFX on Sunday because something I got on Saturday was so delicious that we ate it all on Saturday. One of my favorite things this time of year is the fresh peaches. Mm. Here's my recipe for peach cobbler. The recipe is virtually foolproof and adaptable to different types of fruit. In the dozen or so years I've been making this cobbler, there has never been an instance which I served it and it wasn't asked the recipe. This is true. I'll bet it happens to you, so keep this recipe handy. I will try this over the weekend. But she has 7 to 8 ripe peaches, 1 cup self-rising flour, 1 cup sugar, 1 stick butter, 1 egg. Preheats the oven to 350, peel and slice of fruit, cover the bottom of a 10-inch glass baking dish with the fruit. Fruit should be a 1 inch deep in the dish. In a bowl, mix self-rising flour and sugar. Stir in the egg. The mixture will be crumbly. You may think, did I forget an ingredient? Don't worry, this is how it's supposed to look. Spread the mixture evenly over the fruit. Melt the stick of butter into liquid. Drizzle over the flour and sugar egg mixture. Bake for 35 to 40 minutes or until top is golden brown. Serve with a dollop of whipped cream or vanilla or coffee ice cream. Serves about 6 people. Let's go to Susan in Ellicott City.
Hi, Mark. I just had a comment and a couple of questions. My mother, who is in her 80s in Pittsburgh, for many years belonged to a group in the city of Pittsburgh. They were called the Weed Ladies. They were a bunch of volunteers, primarily in their 60s and 70s, that maintained public gardens. They planted the gardens, I believe. They watered them. They maintained them. And I was just wondering whether or not there's any groups in Baltimore that are maintaining public gardens.
Hmm.
That's my comment, and I just had a question.
Sure.
I grow pickling cucumbers, although we don't pickle them. We just love those Kirby Cukes as our cucumbers. My kids love them. But I tried something new this year, and it didn't work at all, at least not yet. But my normal pickling cucumbers are doing great and producing many. But I bought bush pickling cucumbers, and they're not growing very well. And I did wonder about that. And my favorite recipe this time of the year, I take my homegrown tomatoes, and I maybe chop up a medium-sized tomato, saute some onion in some olive oil, chopped up in a small cooking pan,
mm-hmm.
add the tomato, and just cut up a zucchini. And the juice from the tomato will steam that zucchini, and just put a lid on it, and about 15 minutes, you've got nice, soft zucchini. I throw in some basil for flavoring, dried basil.
Sounds good to me.
Right, the Master Gardeners of Greater Baltimore do a lot of volunteer work in vacant lots and community gardens that neighbors need help with. But at Silburn, a huge cadre of volunteers are usually at Silburn on Thursdays doing volunteer work, and it's a gorgeous place, mainly due to the work of the volunteers there. As far as your bush cucumbers go, I never had any luck with bush cucumbers either. There's a new variety, though, of pickling cucumber called Country Fair. And the real problem with cucumbers is that they're susceptible to the cucumber beetle wilt, which is horrible. It just kills the plants right away just by giving it a disease. And this Country Fair is very, very resistant to this wilt. So try this Country Fair cucumber next time. I think you'll be happy with it.
Tony in Patterson Park, you're on the air.
I live in a row house on Patterson Park, and a lot of us have tried to grow stuff in our backyard, and you can guess that I hope no rats are listening to this show because they might find out where I live, but they already know, actually. I've tried to grow basil. I've tried to grow a bunch of stuff in my garden, and I guess my question is, what can we do about the rats, and also, is it dangerous to grow stuff in the front of your row house on the street? Is there any danger from car exhaust and all that stuff?
How do you know it's rats? That's often cited as a problem in the inner city. And occasionally, when there's a real drought, I've seen damage to vegetables that have a lot of liquid in them. But a lot of other, you know, like my tomatoes get pecked at by birds, for example. It's not rats. Rats are really mainly carnivores.
Carnivores.
Carnivores. Yeah.
Well, The problem is, and they even like, you know, non-edibles, like, well, geraniums are...
But how do you, well, the question was, how do you know they're rats?
Well, the hardy mums that I have been chewed down to the ground, so I don't, you know, it's like, I know birds can't do that. And we'll also have a little bit of burrowing, so I'm pretty sure that they're there. And the things that are getting chewed up are things they like.
You know, there's so much garbage in the alleys and plastic bags that they can go for. I just hang in there and keep trying. There are lots of people in the city that have very successful vegetable gardens in their backyard. So I'd hang in there.
Elwin in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Elwin. Go ahead.
I've got a favorite vegetable that I'm raising that I think is unlike any of the others. This is a classic Bulgarian red pepper that is most suited for roasting. And if you've ever purchased anything like that in a supermarket, you'll appreciate the value of it. I lived in Bulgaria for about 3 years and fell in love with these. And I've got a bumper crop up in my garden this year. And it's an heirloom plant. And again, unlike any other, you can roast it just in a cookie sheet in an oven at about 350 degrees for 10 minutes. And the skins literally just slip right off. And what you've got is just this unbelievably red, succulent roasted pepper.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. Ed, let me also try something else here. Scott in Stewartstown, you're on the air.
Yeah. Well, I have to say my wife is really the gardener. I'm just the bed builder, the manure spreader, and the compost digger.
And we all.
Right? Tomatoes, make salsa out of it. Tomatoes, peppers, onions, whatever you got around. Your own cilantro, do the salsa thing. Especially when you get tired of canned tomatoes like we did this weekend. We had a little family excursion yesterday. We were making dried tomatoes for the kids so they can do for Christmas. Pack them in oil later with the herbs. And then we spent all day yesterday doing pears and all that good stuff. And then add chickens to the mix and you get omelets with all those good fresh vegetables too.
You got chickens?
Chickens.
You have chickens?
Yes, we do.
See, now, it's one of the great joys here. I mean, what I'm hearing from people, you and the others, is that this whole idea of also gardening and having all this, it's a real family affair as well. Oh, I mean, it's just the joy of doing it all, whether it's canning, giving Christmas gifts, or working with your kids to make the gourds or whatever it is. It's just, it's good. It's what keeps us whole. And that's I meant that. Thank you all for being here. It's been a great show today. Well, I want to thank all of our guests this hour, Nancy Taylor Robson, Dr. Joan Maloof, and Larry Close for being here. It's been a pleasure to have all three of you in the studio.
Thank
we should do this
so
at least once a month and give our listeners a chance to really wax forth about their gardens and have their questions answered. And thank you all so much for writing in and calling in with your great questions to make this an enjoyable day. And Nancy Taylor Robson's book, by the way, Course of the Waterman, is a novel, and Dr. Joan Maloof's book we talked about is Teaching the Trees. And thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com.